Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution.
Here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, the 27th of March, 2014. Just four more shopping days left before Obamacare turns into a pumpkin or something like that. And I'm not sure exactly what. But in honor of the deadline, we're going to start off talking about the Affordable Care Act and all the latest and greatest news regarding that scion of legislation. Bill, well, first of all, I guess the question I have to ask is a deadline really a deadline?
Well, the count right now is 37 different revisions to the Affordable Care Act. The most recent one was one that last week they absolutely denied would ever occur. There was never going to be any extension of the March 31st deadline for signing up individual policies. And yesterday they said, well, we have a special exemption for the enrollment period.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a new blue box on healthcare.gov and presumably all the state exchanges as well, that you click and say that you tried before and you couldn't complete the application. And therefore, you have another 2 or 3 weeks to finalize your application. Whether or not any of those people pay an actual premium is a question that nobody can answer, apparently.
Yeah, that's one of those things that they're saying, like, perhaps a quarter of the people who signed up haven't paid for anything yet.
They're saying, they've done a survey, and basically all they can do is they go to the various insurance companies and say, you know, how many people have you got that supposedly, you know, selected a plan but haven't yet paid a premium? And according to the most recent survey from Kaiser Health Poll, about 20% that said they wanted a particular policy have not yet paid the premium.
Oh, okay. So about one-fifth. Now, this delay that isn't really a delay and extension of deadline that isn't really an extension of deadline, I guess it's all on the honor system, according to what I read. But I wonder what that has to do perhaps with the fact that apparently not so many uninsured people have signed up as was originally hoped.
Yeah, well, they had originally said that their goal was to get 7 million people signed up, which I have no idea where they got that number from. But they've modified that, and they said, well, you know, 6 million is going to be good enough. Before the exchanges were open, they said they needed to have 38% that were under the age of 35, I think it was. But they haven't released any numbers in terms of what the age category is of those who have selected a plan. And according to the insurance surveys, it's more like 24 or 25%, not 38%. So the administration is keeping all of their numbers very close to the vest, and I can't imagine that they're not getting those numbers. I mean, when they had the exchanges set up, the different insurance companies had to submit their plans, and presumably they signed a contract with the government saying we're going to provide information on what people signed up for what plans and whether or not they paid the premium. So I can't imagine the administration doesn't have all the numbers it needs. It just doesn't want to tell.
Yeah, I can't imagine it either. And in fact, the thing that strikes me about it is way back when they were originally talking about how desperately we needed to have this program and there were 40 million people uninsured and so forth, how did 40 million devolve into 7 million and then into a fraction of 7 million?
Well, the number, I think it was 30 million, was what Obama campaigned
on. Well, it started about 30, then went to about 35
yeah,
and 40.
Yeah, 30 million
unemployed. It was kind of way up, you know.
The idea was there were 30 million unemployed, or not unemployed, uninsured. And Obamacare was going to solve this problem by getting 30 million additional people signed up. But they have no way, apparently, according to them, of tracking who had insurance before and is now, through the exchanges, simply selecting a new plan for this year or next year, whatever it is, and how many of the people had no plan prior and have signed up. So there's no way to count that 30 million number. It's just impossible.
And to make it even more of a conundrum, and you and I were exchanging emails about this, supposedly anyone who does not have coverage through their employer is going to have to get coverage by next Monday. Monday's the last day, supposedly, or I'll start paying penalties on their taxes in 2015, and the taxes get, or the penalties get worse and worse every year thereafter. Assuming, of course, the Affordable Care Act actually lasts more than a couple of years. We'll have to wait and see on that one, too. But the thing that gets me is we kind of went through the numbers. I was going through the numbers myself. And for one thing, if you go to a website that they set up, ObamacareFacts.com, you can get a bunch of data there. One of the pieces of data they mention is that 56 of the people in the U.S. under age 65 receive health insurance coverage as an employer benefit. Okay, so that suggests that 44% of the people under 65 do not. Now, what is that number? Well, roughly 272 million people are under 65. So 44% represents about 120 million people. And they're saying that 56% of the 120 million already have health insurance coverage through their employer. That means that, what, roughly something like 55 million people are going to need new coverage because almost none of the coverages before actually adhered to this new law, because the new law has all these requirements that the old insurances didn't have. Well, that means there's, what, 50 million people who supposedly need new insurance. And that doesn't even take into account who are the uninsured. That's just pure population numbers. Well, yeah. How does 50 million translate into 3 million? I don't quite get that.
No, the numbers sense. Are well. The reason why it's problematic for the federal government to do this is that medical insurance and all insurance products used to be under the control and authority of the states, and the states did all the tabulations and reporting of who had insurance and who didn't, and so on and so forth, and they were able to make these calculations and report them. But now that the feds have taken over the control for 30 states where they're running federal exchanges, they just don't have the numbers. They have no clue.
Yeah, which is insane.
So it's an administrative mess.
To say the least, yeah. The administration has an administrative mess. Another interesting tidbit from that ObamacareFacts.com. Now, these are all quotes directly from the site. You can go look at it yourself. You basically go to the site and click on the small business section, and that's where I found all this information. But listen to this one quote. 96% of all firms in the United States, or 5.8 million out of 6 million total firms, have under 50 employees and will not be penalized for choosing not to provide health coverage to their employees. 96% of those firms already cover full-time workers. That means less than 0.2% of small businesses, that's 10,000 out of 6 million, will actually have to provide insurance to full-time employees or pay the shared responsibility fee due to Obamacare. So sure. Now they're claiming that virtually everyone who works for a small company full-time already has insurance through their employer, and even part-timers get prorated into that full-time number. They make a real point about that, how you can't avoid it by just making people part-time because they prorate the hours based on how many hours a week your part-timers work. But then they claim that businesses with over 50 full-time equivalent employees are exempt from the fee on their first 30 full-time workers, greatly reducing the negative effect that the law could have on businesses who just barely qualify as a large firm. And today, this is the one that really gets me, almost half of America's uninsured are small business owners, employees, or their dependents. Well, wait a minute. That's a direct contradiction. How on the one hand can you have 96% of the firms being firms that employ 50 employees or under, and that 96% of those firms have already covered their full-time workers, and at the same time say that half of America's uninsured are small business owners, employees, or their dependents? That just doesn't make sense.
I give up. What's the answer?
This is on the same. It's not like I'm drawing from multiple sources here. This is on the same page. You just have to read down the page. So, I mean, clearly, not only do they not know what they're talking about, but they're making it up as they're going along.
Well, do you have an unreasonable expectation for bureaucrats?
I know. I think people should be reasonable. I know. It's a fatal flaw. What do you want?
Well, here's another thing. One of the reasons why the ACA passed the way it did with all the Democratic votes was it also expanded Medicaid. It agreed to subsidize all state costs for expanding Medicaid coverage for the first 5 years or whatever it was. But when you go on the exchange site and they go through the questions and they say, oh, you don't have to do it because you have Medicaid or you have Medicare, or you qualify for Medicare, they do not have a checkbox to indicate whether or not that person is already on Medicare or Medicaid. So they have no idea in terms of the number of people they're claiming, several million, who have been subscribed to Medicaid through the exchanges, whether those are people already on Medicaid or those are people who qualified but hadn't actually filled out the forms to get Medicaid. So there's no way to tell what increase in Medicaid coverage is being extended. It's just not possible.
To make matters worse, where Medicaid is concerned, the Supreme Court had that ruling. I don't remember the exact nature of the ruling, but the gist of it was that they couldn't force the states to take on the Medicaid burden. And so those states that didn't opt into that little system that the Fed set up, currently in those states, the people who are on Medicaid can't qualify for Obamacare. They can qualify for it, but they can't get any subsidies.
Well, yeah, the Supreme Court ruling was in two or three different parts. One of the parts was that they could have the individual mandate, they could have the penalty as long as they called it a tax. So everybody said, well, right. ACA is perfectly constitutional. But in another part, they said, well, the provisions in here regarding Medicaid saying the states must comply or lose all of their Medicaid coverage from the federal government or subsidies, was unconstitutional. They could not bribe the states with money and claim that they had to get, they have to do this Medicaid expansion, otherwise they would lose all of their subsidies from the federal government. So that whole portion of the act was stricken as unconstitutional. As a consequence, there's a fairly large number of states, I think there's 17, they just said, no, we're not going to take the money. We're not going to expand Medicaid. And so state by state, it's hard to tell whether or not any particular Medicaid recipient is going to, be newly qualified on the basis of the new numbers.
Well, actually, I know that they aren't. I know, for instance, in Virginia, I know of people who are on Medicaid who have literally tried to apply, and the site won't let them do it unless they take on a policy that costs them like $900 a month. Now, if you're on Medicaid, you can't afford a policy that costs $900 a month. It's just not even in the realm of possibility.
Well, theoretically, and again, the website just pretty much takes the numbers you put in. If you have a certain amount of income on a yearly basis, they determine whether or not you qualify for Medicaid. So who knows how many people put in the wrong numbers that weren't validated or verified by the IRS or anybody else. They couldn't because nobody's filed their 2013 return yet. And so it's a very puzzling arrangement that the people who are already on Medicaid may not qualify for Medicaid because they entered the wrong number for their estimated income.
Well, actually, it isn't just if they enter the wrong numbers. Even if they enter the correct numbers, just the fact that they qualify for Medicaid because those particular 17 states aren't required to play along with the Medicaid portion of Obamacare, they're basically left without any ability to buy this subsidized insurance that's supposed to be what saves the world, right? So essentially, the Medicaid people who live in those 17 states are faced with, well, if they had enough income, they'd actually end up with a tax penalty next year. But basically, they're forced to continue to be without health insurance, which is directly, diametrically the opposite of what the whole plan is supposed to do.
This was, discussed at some length, and the listeners, I'm sure, have little concern about the individual numbers, but those who were involved when the legislation was being considered said, hey, this doesn't make any sense. the numbers, you know, are, don't add up. You have no way of knowing what the consequences of this legislation is. Nancy Pelosi said, well, we have to pass it first, and then we'll find out what it does.
Well, now we know exactly why that's such a bad idea.
Well, we had discussed the little checkbox and the various 30-some-odd revisions to the law. The other thing that was interesting in this Kaiser Health poll was that they asked the people who did not have insurance, who were uninsured, which was like 39%, whether they were aware of the fact that they were required to get medical insurance through the policy. And they found that 33% of the uninsured say they have tried to get insurance but haven't succeeded. 18% said they got it through the health exchange, but 67% say they haven't even tried to get coverage.
Wow.
So in theory, the purpose of Obamacare is that everybody's covered. Everybody gets a qualified plan. Everybody gets a choice between gold, silver, bronze, or they go on Medicaid, or they're on Medicare. So
or the platinum. Don't forget the platinum.
Forget the which?
The platinum. That's the one that's above the gold.
Oh, the platinum. Yeah, right.
That's where you turn over your firstborn son in order to get health care.
Yeah, well, they have another one. They don't have a medal for it. It's just the straight liability. It's like car insurance, you know, minimum coverage. Oh, it's for catastrophic. That's a category. Now, catastrophic option did not appear on any of the websites. Catastrophic options only apply for people within a particular income range and a particular age range that they would qualify for this catastrophic insurance. But nobody bothered to, you know, put it on the website to explain that they had that option.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I guess it's kind of an appropriate thing when you think about it, because this whole Affordable Care Act is turning into a catastrophe. So, you know, why not just to keep out the catastrophic insurance to protect against it? Oh, no, I guess it doesn't work that way, does it?
Well, Medicare itself is pretty much a catastrophic policy. Part A just covers hospitalization. In other words, if you've got some injury or some disastrous medical condition, you go to a hospital, Medicare covers it. But if you want to go see a doctor about a pain in your hip or, you know, a really bad cold or whatever, Medicare doesn't cover it. You have to pay for the Part B, and if you want your medications covered, you have to pay for the Part D in order to get the coverages from Medicare. So it's Medicare itself is a catastrophic policy.
Oh, by the way, I've been doing some shopping online periodically throughout this whole process to see how stuff plays out and so forth, and also trying to figure out what to do for my wife and I. But just recently, I was doing it through, we moved to Connecticut a couple months ago, and I was doing it through Connecticut's exchange. They have their own setup there because they actually did buy into the whole Obamacare thing. And one of the things that I discovered is that using our numbers, I plugged our numbers in and found that among the plans that we qualify for, among the lowest price plans, there are a couple of bronze plans, both of them through Anthem Blue Cross. One of them has a deductible, I think, of like $12,100, something like that. And it has a $0 copay. The premium on that before any kind of subsidy kicks in was something like $919 a month, something like that. They also have a second one, which has roughly the same deductible. It's around $12,000 instead of $12,100. And it has a $30 copay, and that one costs $1,050. Now, will you please tell me what's wrong with that formula?
Well, here's the thing. Most people don't understand that because they've basically eliminated all of the state rules regarding insurance, they've set up their own rules. And what they've done is they've said, okay, if you, insurance company A, want to offer a bronze plan, it has to be county by county. It can't be zip code by zip code. and age bracket. And that's the only thing you can consider in terms of setting your premium. So you get two or three different companies that say, okay, we're going to offer this price or this price or this price. None of them are allowed to talk to each other, obviously. That would be collusion or something. So it isn't surprising to find policies that are totally incoherent in the same bracket.
Yeah, except there's one problem. There's one problem. Both of these policies came from Anthem Blue Cross.
Okay, well, then the description,
figure that one out.
Doesn't include some provision in these two different policies that isn't mentioned on the website.
I mean, I was going through, you know, they give you the PDF file. They've actually got where they give you a PDF file that has the whole plan laid out. And I was going through the two plans side by side. You know what? I can't find a difference other than the copay and the small difference in the deductible. I can't find one. There may be one in there, and I mean, these things are like, you know, 80 pages long or something like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if there's something in there, but I can't find it.
Well, it may be that one of the plans is an HMO plan, which is basically what almost all the plans are, and the other one that's more expensive is a PPO plan, where you go, you know, within the network or outside the network, and they're still going to cover it.
And that may be the explanation, because one is labeled PPO, although there is no description that I could find about how you go outside the network, which is really weird.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's very confusing, you know, aside from all the website problems they've had, you know, what makes sense in terms of individual policy choices just isn't coherent. And, you know, people that are in the process of moving, or you move from one county to another, and all of a sudden your premiums are going to change and your policy is going to change, and maybe that particular insurance company doesn't even have a policy in that county.
I mean, it exists in that county. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. So it's all very confusing.
Well, speaking of things that don't make any sense, let's take a look at monetary policy, because that never makes any sense. Among the things that don't make sense in monetary policy is that the IRS, well, I guess it kind of does make sense. The IRS actually said that Bitcoins are property. That's a rather interesting declaration. I mean, what else would Bitcoins be?
Before we get to that.
Oh, you have something else on Obamacare?
Yeah.
I thought we were done there.
Well,
I apologize.
Well, it's only I think, important to mention it since we have a few minutes left in the segment. That the Obamacare is in the Supreme Court.
That's true, yeah.
And there were oral arguments yesterday about what's called Hobby Lobby and the religious exemption for employers. Now, this hasn't gone into effect yet in terms of requiring the employer to provide medical insurance. Hobby Lobby offers insurance, which is far exceeds all the Obamacare requirements, except it does not cover various kinds of birth control. And so there's a case in the Supreme Court, Hobby Lobby and some other company, that have said, hey, we want an exemption from the Obamacare mandate for all of these 1, 2, 3, 4 different kinds of birth control that we consider abortifacients. In other words, they result in a fertilized egg being aborted. And so that issue is a very hot topic in the news, and something that the Supreme Court will probably rule on before the employer mandate goes into effect, which is October 1st of this year.
I have to raise a question here. Are conservatives insane? The reason I raise this question is there are a million ways I can think of to say that Obamacare violates the Constitution, violates individual rights, sets us up for a completely inverted economy that gets expenses out of sight, all kinds of things like that. And yet they want to make the argument that it violates their religion?
Yeah. Well,
I honestly think conservatives are insane.
Well, the thing that concerns me is that the Supreme Court may very well find you can have a religious exemption from providing various Obamacare services and so on and so forth, and, you know, preclude that kind of a mandate or offer an exemption. But it's only on religious grounds. It can't be on moral grounds, aesthetic grounds, economic grounds, any other grounds than religion.
So the religious diploma mills are going to start kicking out, and people are going to start making themselves ministers so they can exempt themselves from Obamacare?
Well, that's entirely possible. some decades ago, I there was an organization up in Northern California that was issuing church licenses. For 1995, you could get filing as an official church under the Universal Life Church name. So it was a fascinating thing, because theoretically you could use that, make up your own belief system, make up your own, you know, religious exemptions, and file those under IRS criteria as a religious organization. So there was a big fuss. It was a couple of decades ago. And eventually they said, no, you can't do that, because you're not really a church. You're not really an institution. You're not an organization. You're just a little paper mill that's printing off these documents. So, but it's interesting that in this particular case, one of the arguments of the government in opposition to Hobby Lobby is, well, if you can have a religious exemption for this, why can't you have a religious exemption for anything else that you, you know, you're religiously opposed to? You want to pay, you know, for child labor. You want to be excluded from all of the restrictions on medical care. You know, you want to have doctors that aren't certified by the AMA. You could have all these kind of religious exemptions, and some of them already exist. For example, some religions are opposed religiously to blood transfusions, and therefore they have an exemption. When a hospital is required by law to do a blood transfusion, they will not do it if you say, hey, my religion says this is a bad thing to do.
So the government
all kinds
us,
of weird things.
So the government is telling us that they'd be okay with the idea that we apply this across the board, basically bring the government to its knees and then big government? You know, I'm kind of warming to this idea of religious exemption.
They're saying
I begin to think maybe it's not such a bad idea.
No, if you give Hobby Lobby an exemption for this, then you have to give all kinds of exemptions for everybody else, and that's so ridiculous that you can't possibly make that decision.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, I think it's time to take a break on that one. But after the break, let's pick it up again, and then let's start looking at the insanity of the monetary system, because I still think that gives the healthcare system a run for its money.
Okay.
This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. Here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, Walton Bill on this Thursday evening. And Bill, the IRS has decided to show that they actually know what the word property means. I kind of touched on that before the break, but they're saying that a Bitcoin is property. I guess, like I said before, the real question in my mind is, if it isn't property, what else would it be?
Well, they use the word property, but what they're actually putting it in the class of is a commodity. It's like buying, you know, whatever, pig rinds, you know, orange juice futures or whatever it is. It's a commodity. And what that means for people that are involved in using this Bitcoin so-called currency is that every time that they make an exchange, they have to convert the value into actual U.S. dollars. So if they put $100 into Bitcoin, take $100 out, they have to, you know, it's not $100. They buy 10 bitcoins and they sell 10 bitcoins. They have to figure out how much money they made on every single one of those transactions. And so this is going to be a serious problem for a lot of the merchants who have agreed to accept Bitcoin, because they have to do an instantaneous calculation of what this Bitcoin commodity was worth when they acquired it and what it was worth the next day when it went up $1 or down $1, whatever it was. So it becomes like a commodity exchange rather than currency. Obviously, if it had been currency, then you wouldn't have a net gain that was taxable. The value of the currency just went up, and that's all it was. So the IRS is doing something that makes it simple for them in terms of calculating what your proceeds are and what your income earned was, what your profit was in essence, by treating Bitcoin as a commodity instead of as a currency. It makes perfect sense within the IRS code, but it just totally evades the idea of the Bitcoin actually acting as a currency.
Precisely, it basically says that anything that is a commodity can't be a currency,
right,
which, of course, flies in the face of economics because money itself is a commodity. And
well, but
you can pretend that it's not, but it is. They don't define it as a commodity within the IRS code, so because they get to play with the words, they make it sound like it's not a commodity, but it really is.
Well, here's the thing. It's equivalent to bartering. For example, if I decide to give you a cow and you decide to give me a computer, you can't write cow, paid on your income tax return and computer received. You have to convert those into real actual value at the time of the exchange. So it's trying to convert bartering, which is already covered by IRS laws, into a commodity evaluation, which is going to cause all kinds of problems for Bitcoin.
Well, it's more than that, because if you were to conduct a transaction in euros, you wouldn't have to do the same kind of thing.
Right.
And that's
right.
The key point. The key point is they don't want Bitcoin to be treated the same way that any other currency is treated. They
right.
want to separate the idea of commodity from currency. They want to pretend that currency is not commodity. And there's a very good reason for wanting to do that above and beyond what the IRS wants to do from making it easier for them to force people to provide all the detailed information about tax returns. It also makes it a lot easier for the government to make claims that, the Bitcoin really isn't a currency because the IRS said so.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting administrative conflict here. Because up until now, the only federal department that had claimed any authority over Bitcoin was a division of the Treasury that was involved in requiring registration of people who are engaged in currency transactions. And they said, if you're going to trade in Bitcoin, you have to file and register with the federal government saying that you are a currency transaction processor. So I don't know what happens to that regulation describing it as a currency transaction for which you have to register versus the IRS saying, no, it's not currency, it's property. It's a commodity. So I guess somewhere along the way the bureaucrats will have to say, okay, let's send it over to the Commodities and Exchange Division for them to regulate the Bitcoin currency. So it's an incoherence within two different departments of the same administration.
Incoherence. I like that word. It describes so much of what the government is doing these days. Speaking of incoherence, there is actually incoherence of a coherent kind happening over in China, of all places, because China has decided that they like the idea of bankruptcy, or they're going to tolerate the idea of bankruptcy. Which is kind of a weird thing for a former communist country to do, but I guess that's what happens when you want to pretend that you're a capitalist. I don't know.
Well, it was I'm thinking maybe a couple of months ago there was a news story, CBS or NBC or somebody did it on the abandoned or the ghost cities in China.
Mm-hmm.
Because the government was trying to stimulate the economy, they were passing out all these dollars and making loans at ridiculous rates. And so these huge cities with skyscrapers and residential housing, and there was nobody there. And because there was nobody there, the group that was getting these loans or getting these subsidies simply filed that they had lost all the money. And that was the end of it. you know, and there sits the building, you know. Well, we couldn't get anybody to rent space, so we have a loss in our transaction. Even though we got $5 million from you to build it, we don't have the money left to pay it back. And so that's where the Chinese government is stuck with all these ghost cities all over the country and businesses that have gotten subsidies and government loans that can't pay them back. So they're not going to say, well, we're going to have a bankruptcy code, I guess, so that we can actually attach all of the money that you guys earned by building this thing or took from us as a loan and require you to pay it back as an individual. So it's basically something that China pretty much has to do.
Well, they've got also a problem, though. I mean, the problem is, yeah, they have to deal with all these bankruptcies. But these ghost cities, as you described them, and that's a good term for them, they're all over the place. We're not just talking about a few. We're talking about a huge portion of the country consists of these ghost cities. They're complete. They've got housing. They've got places for storefronts. Many of the storefronts actually have Western store names on them, but they're all empty. It was basically pie-in-the-sky dreaming to do all this. And one of the reasons that these ghost cities grew up in the first place is because China placed limitations on where Chinese people who had money could invest it. And the limitations were so severe that about the only thing they could invest in was real estate. So even though there was far too much money to invest compared to the amount of actual real estate activity that was going on, well, that didn't stop the investors and developers. They just create all these cities out of thin air saying, oh, we'll make money on it one of these days. And, you know, they essentially created a massive real estate bubble that dwarfs the U.S. real estate bubble from 2008. And by dwarfs, I mean like orders of magnitude over in terms of the size and the amount of money that's involved and so forth. So they've got a much more serious problem than just what do they do about the bankruptcies, because if this thing starts to unravel the way it normally would unravel, particularly once they put those bankruptcy laws into place, they've got themselves a popping bubble, and that's not going to be good.
Well, there's an amusing sidelight to this. Sorry, everybody remembers the Solyndra thing where the U.S. government loaned Solyndra $500 million, $500 million for the solar factory. Well, the thing that prompted this decision to go to some kind of a bankruptcy thing was the failure of the Shanghai Chaori Solar Energy Group, which had received a loan of ₩1 billion, I guess is what they're called. I'm not sure what, how many dollars that is. And they just said, hey, we can't pay the loan. You know, the whole business failed. So they've been trying to do these bailouts, you know, at the 11th hour, and they're realizing that this money is gone. The money they loaned for development doesn't exist anymore. And it's exactly the same thing that's happened in the U.S. Solar energy and some of these other subsidized industries are just going belly up.
Yep, the pattern's the same. 1 billion yuan, by the way, is 118 million pounds, so quick math there, I'd say it's probably about $150, $160 million, something like that.
Yeah. Which is plenty of money. I'll take your word for it. How many bitcoins?
I don't dare say because I'll have to report it to the IRS.
Well, we have another industry. I mean, you were talking earlier about the housing industry thing, and there's a whole new set of administrative decisions, court cases, and proposals and legislation regarding Fannie and Freddie.
A lot of Fannie and Freddie in the news, including proposals coming out of Congress, and like you said, court decisions are involved and so forth. And basically, a whole bunch of insanity that probably won't lead to anything, but does have some interesting commentary that comes out of it, including one of the more interesting commentaries from Representative Maxine Waters of California. She introduced a measure that challenges one article describes as the more conservative approach of the panel's chairman, that Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling, whose proposal would reduce the government's role in housing finance. Her proposal basically would replace Fannie and Freddie over time with a new version of Fannie and Freddie. But her reasoning for doing that borders on, well, shall we say, insanity? Let me just read the quote, because the quote pretty much speaks for itself. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's return to profitability and repayment of taxpayer dollars has led some to rightly speculate whether they need any reform at all. I am hopeful that this legislation will continue to move the conversation on housing finance reform forward. Okay, now hold on a second, Congresswoman. They don't need reform. So why did you want to replace them?
She wants to create a new lender-owned cooperative that would issue government-backed loans. That's exactly what Fannie and Freddie are, and have always been.
Go ahead.
You know, it's very strange.
And to make matters worse, I think it was in February, I read where Fannie and Freddie had been doing very well. They had started earning some pretty big profits, and all those profits went to the federal government, despite the fact that they have shareholders. And the government basically bypassed the shareholder. They put in a new rule that said from now on, all profits will go to the government. Well, that's fraud. Because those, I don't think they like Fannie and Freddie. I think investing in it is stupidity beyond any kind of believability. But those shareholders bought in based on the idea that they were going to share in the profits. And now the federal government just says, well, from now on, all the profits go to us.
Yeah, well, let's clarify.
Do that.
It's an interesting conundrum. But let's explain for our listeners who don't know what Fannie and Freddie are. Fannie and Freddie were institutions that were set up by the government with a board of directors appointed by the president that were considered private corporations who would buy mortgage loans from the banks and assume all the risk for those loans. And, of course, when the whole housing industry went bust, Fannie and Freddie were suddenly bankrupt. Well, the funny thing in the quote from Waters is that now that Fannie and Freddie have returned to profitability and are repaying the taxpayer dollars, without saying how they got to be in a profitable status, it was solely because the Fed was printing $50 billion every month and buying up all the Fannie and Freddie, you know, crashed loans. They've been buying the shares of Fannie and Freddie. So right now, I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but right now the Fed itself, which is this conglomeration of private banks, owns most of the interest in Fannie and Freddie.
Right.
So they didn't return to profitability by you know, making good mortgage loans or revising their policies or procedures or anything else. They got it because the Fed was throwing money at them. That's how they were making money.
So review what Representative Waters said. Let's listen to it again. She says, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's return to profitability and repayment of tax dollars has led some to rightly speculate whether they need any reform at all.
Right, because the Fed has bailed them out instead of the federal government.
So essentially, if you get bailed out by the Fed, that means that rightfully proves you don't need to be regulated. You gotta love the logic.
You're way too logical for that.
I'm just reading what it says. I'm not interpreting anything. I'm just putting it in order and saying, wait a minute, A plus B does not equal a toothbrush.
Well, the thing that's amusing is that when Fannie and Freddie were set up, the government, the legislators and the administration said, no, this is a private corporation. We are not liable for the consequences. We are not going to do a bailout if they fail. We are you know, in no way involved in this thing. As soon as they failed, they were the first one to get a bailout. And they literally got, of the stimulus, I think they got like 20 or 30% of the stimulus money, billions and billions of dollars, that were used to bail out Fannie and Freddie, which consequentially bailed out all the banks that had sold them mortgages.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But all I know is that the whole thing is insane. And go back to the very beginning. Fannie Mae was established, I think, in 1970, and Freddie Mac a few years later, basically established by Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they were established with tremendous resistance from the Democrats. Fast forward 50 years later, and now the Republicans want to scale them back a bit, and the Democrats are saying, yeah, here we go, Fannie and Freddie.
Well, the reason why Republicans supported Fannie and Freddie was because in order for the banks and the various mortgage companies to comply with federal law, they had to basically sell mortgages they knew wouldn't be repaid. And so what Fannie and Freddie did was they bought up the mortgages at face value, and now the banks no longer had a liability. It was all in the hands of this private entity that was totally independent of the banks and everybody else.
So basically, the Republicans didn't want the banks to have any liability, and the government and the Democrats said, hey, this is a great program. Let's make sure that the government gets all the benefit out of it.
Sure. Why not?
if you're not totally confused, then that proves you really aren't rational.
Okay. Well, here's now, you know, a lot of this is just standard corporatism in the federal government, where the federal government does one thing to benefit one company and another thing to benefit another company. They pick the winners and losers. But in this particular case that we want to discuss, Bank of America has joined along with Morgan Chase in a special agreement with the federal government to pay $9.5 billion in fines to settle civil lawsuits filed under the Federal Housing Finance Agency on behalf of Fannie and Freddie. So in this particular case, the B of A and J.P. Morgan were basically following the laws, issuing mortgages that the legislation, the regulators demanded of them, and now they're having to pay Fannie and Freddie billions of dollars, and I guess the sum total is something in the neighborhood of $50 to $55 billion, for bad securities that they were required to issue by federal law. And the fact that they sold it to Fannie and Freddie and that they said, here's the current valuation and so on and so forth, and it was all true, and Fannie and Freddie bought it and they took the liability for it, and now the government is saying, hey, this mortgage is no longer worth what it was before. So now you banks are going to have to pay back Fannie and Freddie under the Federal Housing Financing Agency. So now all of the money that the banks might have had for loaning out to small businesses or individuals for regular loans has just disappeared. And it's gone into Fannie and Freddie, so now they're profitable. And now we consider,
Well, all that you're saying is true, but there is another piece of the puzzle that you're not mentioning, which is the government didn't actually tie their hands behind their back saying, you must loan this money out, and the banks were saying, no, we don't want to loan the money out. Quite the opposite. I mean, they were clamoring to lend this money out. They were fighting really hard to lend it out. They were demanding. They were selling it as hard as they possibly could. This was not a reluctant release of funds by the banks.
Well, it wasn't.
I mean, what you're saying is true, but let's look at the whole picture.
Yeah, well, no, I understand. I mean, the banks wanted to make money, and so they were delighted to have Fannie and Freddie there. They just sell the mortgage to Fannie and Freddie, and they don't have to worry about it anymore. They have zero risk. And that was intentional. I mean, that was why the Republicans supported it. That's why, it was implemented in the first place, was to protect the banks from the liability for bad mortgages.
Except it turns out that there was a risk.
No doubt.
It just wasn't a stated risk, because the risk was that they're going to be charged with fraud, which is what happened. They're charged with fraud for obeying the law that they're required to obey.
Exactly.
Enthusiastically.
Right. You got it. You got it.
We live in a crazy world. You realize that, Bill, don't you? but you have to know, to me, there's a bigger lesson here. There's a much bigger lesson. The entire monetary system, this expansionary monetary system, is based on the idea that the central bank has to be there to protect us from banks making poor lending decisions. And what we see here is a case of, well, yeah, banks were making poor lending decisions. Of course, they were required to make these poor lending decisions by the government. And when they followed the law and did what they were supposed to do, the government accused them of fraud. And all of this was not only not stopped by the Fed, which was created to deal with these situations, but actually the Fed fanned the flames because they're the ones who kept ratcheting up the money supply to keep feeding into the banks so they could keep lending the money out in the first place. And that's the bigger lesson. The bigger lesson is this whole monetary system, based on this central banking system that was supposed to protect us against bank overreach, actually produces diametrically opposite results. It actually fuels the fire and actually drives the banking system to make more and more foolish decisions. That's a big lesson to learn.
Yeah, well, I agree. And there's two other, you know, aspects to this. I usually do a lot of research on these stories. I understand exactly what's going on.
And it's very much appreciated, by the way.
On this particular story, because it just came out yesterday or even this morning, I think, about B of A, they didn't describe what was alleged to have been the fraud that these banks committed in issuing the mortgages. So maybe I'll do a little research and we can bring it up again tomorrow. But the other thing was that, of course, the government solved all these problems because they adopted Dodd-Frank.
Yeah.
And the Dodd-Frank regulations require a bank to basically only lend to the most creditworthy customers and to reduce their risks almost to zero on every single loan that they issue. Well, the consequence is that the big corporations have the ability to borrow all kinds of money because they're, you know, AAA rated or whatever it is, and there's no money left for the individuals out of there in the market buying cars and other products.
Well, it does raise an interesting question, then, because with the funding of Fannie and Freddie and the banks by the Fed over the course of roughly depending on where you, how far you want to go back, anywhere from a 5 to a 25-year period. Because of that, it led to a housing bubble, and housing bubble that burst in 2008. And when the bubble burst, that's when these charges of fraud originated that ultimately culminated in banks like Bank of America, JP Morgan, Chase, all being charged with fraud, fraud that's an undefined fraud, and being held accountable for what happened. Well, if the same... if that happened and under that kind of a bubble situation, what happens if a similar bubble erupts under this system you just described, where the corporations are being funded by the Fed to essentially take back their stock and screw everybody else and make it look like the stock market's going crazy? What happens when that crashes? What happens if that crash actually ends up leading to a similar kind of domino situation where the economy is going to fall apart and they have to bail out the corporations, all that kind of thing? Will the federal government then say to those corporations they did what the government wanted, to borrow that money so that they could go buy back their own stocks and make themselves wealthy and so forth? Will they then charge those corporations with fraud using the same principle?
Of course.
Well, if that's the case, then I have to ask one final question. Is there any sanity left anywhere in the country?
Well, see, that's the reason why Congress passes laws that are extremely vague and leaves it in the hands of the administration, these various bureaucratic organizations, to decide what the rules are. Because the law makes no sense, the rules can't possibly make any sense. Now, whether it's Obamacare or Dodd-Frank or whatever it is, Congress has basically given up any responsibility for the consequences of the laws they pass. And therefore, when everything goes bad and goes down in the wash and it's a train wreck and everything else, it can't be the Congress that's responsible for the consequences. It has to be private businesses. And those private businesses have to be charged under some provision or another so that they pay a fine and they cover the expenses. Or they have the Fed just print up some more money, pass it around, everybody's happy, they got lots of money to pay off their bills, and get out of debt, and everything is copacetic.
Well, I guess that pretty much sums it all up. Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Hey,
we'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.